I want to give you your assignment in your reading your text. Give it to you right now, that way I won't forget to do it later. This one's a very short one. You only need to read pages 44 through 48. So, just five pages there. 44 through 48 in your textbook by Monday, okay? So that'll give you something to do tomorrow afternoon when you're sitting around and looking at the rain. You can pull your book out and read your assignment. Then I have a handout I want to give to you. If I could have, let's say, two volunteers to pass these down the aisles. It's file number 3, chronology file, and we'll look at that for a minute when we get it passed out. It's used in about 4 classes, but where it says Survey of Old Testament History, it's file number 3. Now, the one I happened to grab had the pages stapled out of order, so you might want to check and make sure that the first page is page 1 and not page 3 or something. I don't know if they... Hopefully they didn't duplicate that mistake by 50, did they? Oh boy, I guess in some cases it did, it sounds like. But you'll have to change it around. Did everybody get one now? File 3, any extras back there? If there are, just send them back up to the front and we'll collect them. Okay, let's look at this then. If you can find page 1, we start at a good place to start the beginning with Adam. Now these dates, as the little note indicates, are not absolute. They're based on the indefinite archaeological date of such and such and this and that and the other, and it goes ahead and tells you what some of the points are in chronology, but that's one thing you want to keep in mind, that these are only approximate dates, and we're not going to be real dogmatic on them. For example, on the creation date, some only go back to 4000 BC and feel that we should just go back to 4000 and keep it in even 1,000-year segments in keeping with that 1 day to 1,000 year situation that we talked about in class, I think it was last week or maybe week before. And so there's room for difference of opinion on some of these matters, but still it does have some benefit, even if you can't be absolute on the dates, at least to be able to see the overview of the thing. That's what the benefit is, to be able to see who lived when and which lives overlapped with which lives, and particularly when you get into the more detailed and therefore complex part of our history that we're going to hit the end of the semester when we start getting into the kings of Israel and the prophets and the various nations involved. It starts getting a little bit sticky in some points, and it's helpful to have something like this to be able to pull out and just get a quick overview and a glance. But anyway, so we've got the name, the timelines for the lives of Adam and Seth and Enos and some of the other ones back there. Continues on to page 2. Notice Noah there from Lamech. And Enoch, of course, translated to heaven, so he lived only 365 years, and God caught him out. Then, we're in our lecture, we're just about at this point where Noah is there, and the sons of Noah after the flood there, so that's just right about where we are, not at the birth of Noah, but I think he was 500 years old when the flood came, 500 or 600, I can't remember, somewhere around there. It states it there. And see, I guess he would have been 500 They've got his life ending at the flood for Noah. No, they don't. I'm looking at Lamech. Or I'm looking at Methuselah's life. So Noah did continue. They've got 600 years. I think that 600 years should be how old he was at the flood there. That one date might be a little bit out of place. Or that one figure. So Noah, then Shem. We did not put Ham and Japheth, his other two sons, on here, but we did put Shem. And so you see Shem, and then all of those under there from the line of Shem. Arphaxad had Selah, had Eber, had Peleg, had Ru, Sarag, Nahor, Terah. And then Terah continuing on page 3, down near the lower part of the upper half, you see Terah, and then Abram, whose name was changed to Abraham. So that's the important line, because that's the line that the Bible history is going to be following. It's not going to follow out the line of Japheth. It's not going to follow out the line of Ham either. Well, it'll tell you a little bit, just mention briefly their offspring, but after that it'll go on and leave them by the wayside, so to speak, and it'll focus in on Shem and his lineage, because from him, of course, Abraham came, and God made that all-important covenant with him. And so that's the line. It's Noah's line through Shem that Bible history is going to be tracing, okay? And so that's the only one that we've bothered to continue with on this. So Abraham lived for 175 years, had Isaac, who lived 180, who had Jacob, who lived 147. His name was changed to Israel. He had 12 sons. And looks like we've given you only the line of Levi there. One of the 12 sons of Jacob was Levi. He lived 137 years. He had Kohath. Now we're on the bottom part of page 3. Who had Amram. And Amram had Moses. And so that's the reason that we just gave you one of the 12 sons there. Obviously, there wouldn't be room for all 12, for one thing. Another thing, when we get into the book of Exodus, it's going to be centering on Moses as the one that God raises up to pull Israel out of Egypt. And so therefore, we showed you where he came from. Moses came from the tribe of Levi, as did his brother then, of course, Aaron. So Moses, and then we show Moses, Joshua, the elders, and the other leaders, the later ones to lead Israel, giving you another kingdom there, since Egypt comes into the Bible picture with Moses, and even before that with Joseph, we give you some of the Egyptian dynasties there. Most of these dates, by the way, will probably correspond pretty much to the plastic charts that John Whitcomb put out, J.C. Whitcomb. You may have those. One's called Patriarchs and Judges. Another one's called Kings and Prophets. And they're for sale on the book counter for, I don't know, a couple dollars or less each. And these dates pretty much correspond with the dates that we've given here. Page 4 is where things really get detailed. Yes? I can't hear you. You have to speak up. Uh-huh. Less accurate. Yes, you have a better time figuring Egyptian dates by using Bible history than you do from using Egyptians' own history because of gross inaccuracies and distortions on the part of the few historians who recorded Egyptian history that has come down to us. Berossus and Herodotus and a few others who mentioned some things go back 100,000 years or more, supposedly, in some of their dates, and some of them are so obviously mythological because some of them have kings over Egypt who rule several thousand years each, showing that that myth and fable had been mixed with the history by the time it came down to them or when they wrote it, one or the other. And so there are more inaccuracies in Egyptians' own history, and there are no inaccuracies in any Bible historical statement concerning Egypt. But they haven't totally thrown out the Egyptian. They've tried to just pretty much see how the two correlate. Using your Bible, best way to go is to use your Bible chronology, because those are the dates you can be a little more sure on, and then try to fit it in with what's talked about certain kings of Egypt in the Bible, and try to find which corresponding kings those would talk about that ruled over Egypt, regardless of what dates or what kind of year span they would give in Egypt. And that's what some have done. Try to correlate, in other words, the two. All right? Page 4, then, as I say, is where it gets much more detailed. Back in page 3, just for a minute, you look at Moses. Remember what happened. They come out of Egypt in the Exodus. Of course, we'll be going over all this in class. But just to show you an overview here. Then he leads them through the wilderness, and eventually he dies, and it's Joshua who takes them across Jordan, and they come into Canaan and dispossess the Canaanites and set up their nation there. And so Joshua is listed next. Then the elders. There were certain elders in the land that outlived Joshua that ruled over the people for a short period of time. And then from that time and on, for the next 350 years or so, you have the period of the judges, and that begins with Othniel, the first judge over Israel. Then you see the others: Ehud, Deborah and Barak, Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, Jair, Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, Samson. Those are the judges. Okay? And we'll be talking about that period when we get to it. Then, up above, you see Eli and Samuel. Eli the high priest during that time, Samuel being who is generally reckoned as the last judge over Israel. Okay, he was a prophet, a priest, and a judge. And so he passes from the scene, and Israel has their first king. They ask for a king, and so they get one, and that's up the top, Saul. Reigned 40 years, followed by David, followed by Solomon. All right, and then after Solomon's death, the kingdom divides. Northern kingdom, or the 10 tribes, or Israel, up the top, and then down below, the southern kingdom, or Judah, where David's descendants reigned. And so that's why you have two bars from that point on. Then the northern kingdom. I made a mistake. It's the other way around. Judah, or the southern kingdom, is on the top bar of the two, and the bottom one is Israel. I just assumed that Judah would be in the bottom because, you know, southern kingdom, you figure would be underneath. It's the other way around on this one. So, and it's just as well because, like I say, these are all from the line of David in the southern kingdom. So the bar would want to continue there unbroken. Now, down at the bottom then, you see that Israel, the northern kingdom, ends around 722 B.C. with the Assyrian nation coming down and taking them captive. And so that's why it ends with Hosea there, if you'll see that, then that last king of Israel. And the prophets down below that, with question marks on the dates of their ministry, they're, many of them are questionable, and that's why those are put there as to exactly where they go. We know the basic era during which they ministered, but as far as precise beginning dates and ending dates for their ministry, we don't know. That's why the question marks are there. So don't think that that question mark means that they could have prophesied, you know, 200 or 300 years on either side of that. It doesn't mean that much. It just means that you could slide it a little bit, you know, a few years one way forward in time or backward in time for some of these prophets. Okay. Then the southern kingdom continued. Hezekiah, Manasseh, Ammon, Josiah, Jehoiakim, Jehoiakim, and with Zedekiah, the Babylonians come down, and they take Judah away captive, and that's the end of them as a nation for 70 years. We have listed the Babylonian kings and the Persian kings down at the bottom. And then after 70 years, they return to the land. So the bar continues again. And they rebuild the temple. And they have no more kings but governors over them, like Ezra and Nehemiah. And so this takes you all the way up to about 400 B.C. And then after that, you have the 400 silent years, as it's called, before Christ. So this is a little chart then, just to orient you to what we're going to be looking at in class. Any questions on that? Okay. Yes.
What are these little question marks mean?
I just stated what they meant. Were you here?
I must have been sounding real
bit. Oh, they mean, for example, like the prophets. Is that what you're looking at there? And there's on each side is a question mark of the line. That means that we can't be real precise as to when exactly they began their ministry or ended it. We know in most of the prophets who were the kings of Israel during which they ministered. For example, you know that Hezekiah was king when Isaiah ministered because you see him talking in the book of Isaiah and in the historical books. So we can give general, you know, lines as to when these prophets ministered. But as far as giving precise beginning dates and ending dates for their ministries, in the case of most of them, we can't. And so that's why we put question marks there, just so we won't get real dogmatic on that. Okay? Yes? No, in most cases it was because a king would put his son in a position of ruling with him, generally during the latter years of that king. And this is called a co-regency, meaning there's two co-rulers at the same time. Not necessarily having equal weight and authority over the nation. Generally the father would have the final say in most matters, and the son would be under him. It was almost like they were almost on-the-job training to be king, in a sense, because they were, you know, they were learning it, obviously, younger and so forth, while they were having authority and power over the nation. And so that's what that is. Yes? Okay, one that turned out bad. Anybody else have one that just so faded that you can't read it at all? We do have some extras if that's the case. Okay. Any other questions on it then? Might be a good idea for you to keep it kind of handy each day, each Monday and Friday when you come into class, and just kind of slip it under the edge of your notebook or your notes or something, so that if I start expounding on a point and I start grabbing all kinds of historical, you know, points, and I kind of lump them all together and I talk about this and I go on, and you say, when did Samson come? He talked about Samson, and you can just whip this little baby out and look through there, and you can find right where he came in reference to the other judges, came toward the end, and so forth. Okay? All right. Let's get back into our story then. We're talking about the sons of Noah. Chapters 9 and 10 of Genesis. I'm not going to bore you with verse references in most of these cases. I could say, you know, chapter 9, verses 1 through 5 is such and such, verses 6 through 10 is such and such, but after a while that would be such a tedium that I'd have to hit you on the head to keep you awake. So instead of doing that, I'll just give you the chapter. And you'll just, and I won't give you each verse that I'm referring to when I talk about an incident in that chapter, okay? Chapter's all you need for the, for this intents and purposes of this class. And if you wanted to go back through and put verses in your notes, why, that'd be fine. Now, as we see, Noah had three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Now, I will be giving you later on a handout which will give you what we call the family tree, with Noah, his three sons, and the sons of Ham, Shem, and Japheth, descendants of Noah's sons, and the nations that evolved from them. But just to state very briefly in a generalized fashion, Ham became the ancestor of the Egyptians. That's one people that was descended from Ham. The Canaanites, those are the people that were in Canaan when Israel came in. They were from Ham. Also, the African nations also were descended from Ham. Shem, of course, is notable because Abraham will come from Shem. And Abraham is going to take up the lion's share of Genesis 12 through 25. So we'll want to keep our eye on Shem. The Assyrians and some other nations also came from Shem, as well as the Arab nations, because as we shall see, Abraham has two sons, more than two, but two primarily, Ishmael and Isaac. And it's from Ishmael, son of Abraham, that the Arab nations are descended. And it's from Isaac, other son of Abraham, that the Jews are descended. So it's kind of interesting that the Arabs and Jews that have been fighting all of these thousands of years are related. They're all coming from, they all look to Abraham as their father, although from different mothers. The Arabs came from Hagar, as we shall see, an Egyptian woman, slave woman, and concubine. And the Jews came from Isaac through, of course, Rebekah, wife of Abraham. Then Japheth. Most of the Europeans are descended from Japheth, as well as the Asians and the Orientals. They come from Japheth. Now Shem, that word means name, and it's significant because it is from Shem that Abraham will come, and eventually Jesus Christ from the line of Shem. And of course he is that one who's been given what? A name which is above every other name, which is named in heaven and earth, Philippians 2:9. And so it's referring to these are going to be the people of the name, they were called. Ha Shem, the name. That's what the Hebrews will be, the people of the name, because they have the name of God, Yahweh, and they have God. And so Shem, it will be those that will be his lineal descendants that will carry on the revelation of God, and that will continue to have a relationship with God through history, as we see here. Ham means swarthy. And his offspring are cursed. Not so much that God is a respecter of persons, because he is not. And he's not saying, I'm going to arbitrarily bless this people, I'm going to arbitrarily curse that people. But by God's foreknowledge, knowing that these would be the peoples that would in general reject most of the knowledge of God and live in the most reprobate way, he therefore, on the basis of that, cursed Ham and his line. And this curse, of course, was more of a prophetic national declaration of what was going to happen to these peoples than it was God forcing them to do this or to do that, of course. Most likely, the Negro race descended from Ham, although there are Caucasian races which descended from Ham as well, because the Canaanites that were in the land when Israel came were a white race and not a black race. And the Egyptians were either mixed or were white, one or the other. So the race thing, I can't explain it to you in a scientific way, because I don't have the scientific background to explain to you how how men, through intermarriage and having and separating themselves and living in various places of the earth, would the racial characteristics of skin color, facial features, and bodily shape and so forth would arrive. But suffice it to say that it did, and that's how it came from. Okay? Yes. Swarthy means dark. Japheth, his name means widespreading, and that is prophetic as well, because, as I noted, the Europeans, Asians, and Orientals came from Japheth, and so God foreknew that Japheth's descendants would be more widespreading as to their migration across the globe than Shem's and Ham's, because Ham's descendants basically populated the continent of Africa, although part of this Bible lands as well, like we talked about Canaan and so forth, but basically Africa. And Shem's descendants, it's basically what we call the Bible lands of Palestine, Syria, the Syrians are Shemites, the Assyrians, the Elamites, and so these are Shemites in here, Hamites there, and Japhethites up into Europe and up into Asia, and the Orientals in the Far East as well. So he was widespreading. His descendants populated a greater segment of the globe. Japheth is going to receive a blessing as well in these prophetic blessings that Noah states on his three sons, but his blessing will be less than that of Shem, because again, Shem, from him will come the people that keep the revelation of God. Now that brings us to Genesis chapter 10, which is basically just a genealogy. Basically, it simply lists who are the sons of Ham, who are the sons of Japheth, who are the sons of Shem. So it's been called by the commentators the Table of Nations, because it's like a table or a list of the nations, because all the various nations were coming from these men as they would migrate and move across the land. These men became the ancestors of all the nations of the earth. But we have an interesting insert, as it were, in this genealogical list that's found in verses 6 through 8. And it's in the list of the sons of Ham. We see that Ham had Cush, Mizraim, Phut, and Canaan there. And verse 8, Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. And the correct Hebrew here is that he, meaning Nimrod, went forth to Assyria, and built Nineveh, and the city of Rehoboth, and Calah. So Nimrod becomes a very powerful and influential man during his life. He's descended from Ham through Cush, and he founded an empire, or a kingdom, here in Mesopotamia. And he built Babel, which became Babylon. He built Erech and Calneh and Akkad, and then he went up into Assyria, what would later become Assyria, and he built Nineveh, and mentioned some other cities there as well. So he was a kingdom builder, he was an empire builder, and he was a very influential man, and the evidence is quite clear that he eventually... We don't know how he started out, if he started out with good motives to help man out or started out with bad motives, but it's quite clear that at the end he began to use his power to dominate men, to rule over men, to lord it over men. And he began to be anti-God in his philosophy and to want to exalt man and to put God down. And therefore he's the first type of the Antichrist. At least after the flood times here, he's the first one that we see that stands for that man of sin who exalts himself, opposes himself against all that is called God, as we see in 2 Thessalonians 2. In fact, even in his name that is seen, for the name Nimrod means rebel. And he would seem to be a rebel against God. Now, one reason why I can say this about Nimrod is from what we see when we get into chapter 11. Because it talks about the whole earth being of one language, everybody had one language, and they're journeying from the east and they find a plain in the land of Shinar, which is the ancient name for Babylon. And they dwelt there, and they said one to another, "Go and let us make brick and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And they said, "Go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach into heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad on the face of the earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, and let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." And so the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build a city. And therefore the name of it was called Babel, because the Lord there did confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. See, man was in rebellion against God by ever starting out to do this. Because after Noah and his sons came out of the ark, God said, "Multiply and replenish the earth." See, in other words, just scatter and go abroad and fill up the earth and repopulate it. But no, man said, "Lest we be scattered," as we just read. We don't want God to scatter us. We want to have power, you know, power to the people, so to speak. Man, you know, power for man to do what he wants to do, rather than following God individually. And so they built a tower, which was perhaps a temple, in which they were going to reach up, not to heaven, they knew they couldn't get that high, but just into the heavens, reaching into the heavens, and they would worship the sun and the moon and the stars. Probably all astrology and paganism had its origin right here at the Tower of Babel and in this false religion. And so God had to come down and take the one language that man had and turn it into many, many languages, and then, not being able to understand one another, they couldn't go through with their plans for a manned world empire headed up by Nimrod, because it said he started Babel, and this is Babel, so he's the head of this. And so God scattered them, and whoever had the same languages would obviously have a natural kinship to stay together, because they can communicate, and they would go and they would form one nation, and they'd go off and form another, and they scattered across the face of the earth by God. And so it says the name of the place was called Babel, because the Lord there did confound or confuse the language of all the earth. And Babel is a Hebrew word meaning confusion. And so the name of the place was Babel. He called it Babel or confusion because there God confused the language of man in order to thwart his plans. Yes. Most likely, yes. Most likely, there may be some cases where the parent, you know, just thought that he was the one that thought of the name. Oh, you know, Shem would be a good name, you know, name. And so he gave him that name, but not unknowing, unbeknownst to him, God really dropped it in his heart, because God knew that they were going to be the people of the name, and that the Hebrews, Israel would come through them, Jesus would come through them, and through Jesus, all of Christianity, and so Shem. So we're not told. In some Bible cases, you are told. There are some cases where God actually came to the husband or to the wife and said, "You shall," you know, like in Jesus' case, "you shall name call his name Jesus." He told him what to name him because of the revelation that was going to be involved there. And there are a few other cases as well, but God didn't necessarily always do it in that way. He may have just dropped it in their heart without them even knowing it, and they named it. But the point that you have to keep in mind, and this is a salient point, because it's not really also important how God did it, is that he did it. And that's what you need to keep in mind, that God was involved in the naming of many of these individuals. And so the names had a meaning, and those people knew the meaning of that name. And even though they might not always understand the full prophetic import of that name, yet God did. And when it's laid out in the Word of God, we see why, because it fits into later history and what will become of that man or that people or that race or whatever. And so that's why God had it stated that way. There was another hand earlier. Did you still have a question? Or?
Yeah.
Yes, I was talking about Nimrod because it says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So tying it in here with Babel, that means it has to be him that's involved in it, even though he's not named in this account. Okay, so Nimrod was the founder of Babylon and the founder of Assyria. And as I say, this city and this tower probably was a temple, and a tower temple tower. And up at the top of the tower was a temple, and at night they could go out and see the stars of heaven, and they began to worship the creation more than the Creator, as Paul says in Romans chapter 1. And so the foundation of astrology, paganism, heathenism is most likely right here at Babel. In fact, in many of the religions of the world, if you ever do a study of comparative religion, where you're comparing the various religions of the world, you'll find certain patterns, certain keys, certain symbols, certain concepts, which are shared by all religions, showing that they all most likely had a common source. And that common source is probably right here at Babel. You can trace them right back here. All right? So this time he didn't wipe out the whole earth like he had with the flood. This time he allowed man to continue to live, but he had to do something to thwart his plan, and so he confounded them. And supernaturally, and how he did it I don't know, but supernaturally he gave men separate different languages. And we don't know what the original language was. Some of the older scholars used to contend for Hebrew, that was the one language that all men spoke at one time. And their feeling for that was that because the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, so it's the sacred tongue, as they would say. But there's no evidence that it was necessarily Hebrew or any language that is in existence today. It may have been a totally different language. And then he just totally took that from their, you know, from their minds, and then gave each group another language that was separate to themselves, and then they couldn't continue to communicate, and so Nimrod's plans were thwarted, and the people just left off. Because you don't have power over people if they're not going to accept your rule. And how can they accept rule from a man they don't even understand, see? And imagine how many years it would take to try to get all the languages translated and interpreted, and for one person to learn many languages and to try to get them back together. And so there was no way he could pull them back together then. It was too late. And God scattered them at that time. So we don't know what that language was. Yes? We don't know. It doesn't give a tight chronology for those various cities that he founded as listed in Genesis 10. It just says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and such and such. But since it does state the beginning of his kingdom was at Babel, that may be tipping us off that after God, you know, confounded their languages and they left off building the Tower of Babel, that maybe it was at that time that he went up 400 miles to the north to found the nation of Assyria by building Nineveh. So it may have come in that way, or it may have had them all going kind of contemporaneously, and then God came down and confounded his plans at Babel. But it would seem to indicate that Babel was the first one, and that's where he was trying to get them all together in one place. And God confounded him, and then he went on and continued to build kingdoms, but he was not able to get everybody together in them. Just maybe after that it was only the people that understood his language who would later become the Assyrians or maybe the Babylonians that he could, you know, keep under his grip, and went on to found other cities. Okay? So this typifies, this Babel, which came to be later Babylon, typifies the kingdom which is right around the corner from us. Anybody who's got his eyes open and is watching the direction the society is headed in today, and the governments around the world, and the push that is around, and some of it's subtle and some of it's not so subtle, knows that there, and reading Bible prophecy and understanding it, that there is another last world government on its way, and so that's the end time Babylon. You see that in Revelation 17, verses 4 and 5, where that woman, harlot church, who is sitting astride the beast or world government, there's a name written on her forehead called Mystery Babylon, Mother of Harlots. Now, a mother means she's the source of harlots. She's the source of false religious and worship systems. And that source is right back here at Babel. And so that's showing us that the roots of this end time kingdom go all the way back through Rome, Greece, Medo-Persia, Babylonia, Assyria, Egypt, and then Babel at the beginning there. Also, 2 Thessalonians 2:7. where we see that there's a mystery of iniquity that culminates in a revelation of a man of sin, or the Antichrist, who is against God. And he's typified here by Nimrod. So just as God destroyed Babel, or Babylon, he shall also destroy the end time Babylon. And we know that that's the purpose of the plagues, and it will terminate at the second coming when he sets up his kingdom on earth. Revelation 18 for that, and 19. Those two chapters deal with the plagues in the second coming, which will terminate the Antichrist's kingdom and rule. Then the rest of chapter 11 is the generations of Shem. And now we are interested in them because we're going to pick it up with the story of Abraham. So Moses, under inspiration of the Spirit, is giving you nine generations from Shem to Abraham. So Abraham was Shem's great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, I think. I think I got the number of them right there. Anyway, nine generations of people between Shem and Abraham, as you see in this chapter. Now, these nine generations are merely listed and passed over without much comment at all. So you're looking at a pretty big chunk of Bible history that God passes over in almost total silence, because there was nothing worthy of recording in terms of the plan of His salvation of the world, or whatever else would be necessary for us to know during that period of time. It was just men continue to go on and multiply and grow and so forth, until He comes to this one, Abram, and then the spotlight stops, so to speak, right on him, and then we begin to see this man as an individual. Because it's with Abram that it was to Abram that God manifested Himself and made him a covenant, which led to Jesus Christ, through whom the world can be saved. It's possible that those nine generations are passed over in relative silence because Abram was the first one since Noah that had any kind of a heart for God, that God could work with, and that God could lead, and that God could direct. And, you know, He can only work with what we give Him, okay? And so maybe you had nine generations of people there that didn't give Him a whole lot to work with, until finally Abram came along and God saw inside of his heart what kind of a man he was and would be with the knowledge of God, and therefore He gave him that knowledge, and he did some great things with it. Possible exception to that would be Shem. There's some slight indications that Shem may have had a real heart for the Lord as well, but not much said about him there. It's more by inference than by clear statement. So with the exception of Noah, and then possibly Shem, for several hundred years here then, Abram is the first one to come along that God can really work with. And so that leads us to the story of Abraham, which is going to take us from chapter 12 all the way to 25 in Genesis. Now, just to recap, the 11 chapters we've just looked at, it deals with the primeval history of man. And God covered approximately 2,000 years of history in 11 brief chapters. And it deals with mankind as a whole. Now, beginning in chapter 12, God starts with the story of Abraham. And to cover only about 300 years of history, God is going to take the next 39 chapters of this book. And 39 plus 11 makes 50, and that's the whole book of Genesis. So Genesis takes only 11 chapters to tell you about the first 2,000 years of history, and then it takes the last 39 chapters of the book to tell you about only 300 years of history, showing you that there must be something important about what happened during that 300-year period of history versus the first 2,000 years that God took the pains to slow down and tell you in detail what's going on. And that is exactly what the case is. There is something important. Namely, there is someone important. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Jacob's 12 sons, especially Joseph. And that's what the whole rest of the book of Genesis, in fact, is going to be about. Abraham, Isaac, Joseph, and Joseph's 12 sons, but particularly Jacob. Thank you. Jacob's 12 sons, but particularly Joseph. Now, a glance at our little chart that we just handed out here shows us that Shem lived on into the time of Abraham, and possibly even farther. It's on page 3 up at the top. You see Abraham being born probably somewhere between 2150 and 2200 BC. And notice the line of Shem for his life goes way up all the way almost till 2000 BC. If we are accurate and if we've got enough to work with here. Showing that Shem lived not only during Abraham's day but even Isaac's day. And some feel he may have even lived a little bit longer, even up into the time of Jacob. But at least during the time of Abraham, for sure. Which is interesting, because here's Abraham, 9 generations removed from Shem, which would make him 10 generations from Noah and the flood, and Shem is still alive, because he lived so long, 500, 600 years, whatever the figure is, I don't recall. Where was Shem during the days of Abraham? The Bible is silent on that. But it's interesting to speculate that Abram may have known Shem. There may have been some relationship there, but we're not told. Whatever the case might be, at least this much is for sure. Shem would be a link to the pre-flood world, to those in Abraham's day. He would be able to tell stories about what the world was like before the flood, much different than after the flood, and tell about Noah. And he wasn't all that far removed from Adam and the very first men on the earth. And so he could remember. Obviously, people are keeping oral history, if not written, at least oral. And so he was able to tell stories about Adam and about the fall. They knew these things. And this may have been passed on to Abram if Abram had contact with Shem. He may have not, though. If there's a possibility that he may, but there's a possibility that he may not have known Shem. Shem may have lived in a different place, maybe up closer to Mount Ararat where the ark landed. And Abram may not have even ever met him. In fact, Abram may have even been an idolater when God called him. Abram may not have had the knowledge of God, possibly, when he was called by God. Because we know that at least his father was an idolater, and we can presuppose that, you know, for maybe some generations before them, they were idolaters. Not going back to the time of Shem, but going back sometime. Proof of that is found in Joshua 24 and verse 14. We won't look that up, but Joshua tells Israel to put away the gods that their fathers served on the other side of the Euphrates River. That means over here in Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham comes out of. That's on the other side of the Euphrates, okay? Here's the Euphrates River right here. And so on the other side of the Euphrates is Ur, and they were serving other gods. They meaning at least Terah, and perhaps Abram as well. But nevertheless, even if he was an idolater, he had a hunger to know the true God. And he had that, whatever that is in man that reaches out for God, and God saw that heart, and therefore he revealed himself to Abram. So Abram lived in what the Bible calls Ur of the Chaldees, Chaldees. This area here in Chaldea is actually southern Babylonia, but there's a mountain range in here, and there was a people called the Chaldeans that lived here at an early time, and so it came to be known as Chaldea. But eventually, when Babylon became a nation, it became incorporated into it, so that the Bible often uses the term Chaldeans or Chaldeans as synonyms for Babylonians. They're one and the same in terms of the nation. So he came out of Babylon then. Southern Babylon, Ur of the Chaldees, right near the head of the Persian Gulf here in what today is the nation of Iraq. Now, Babylon, as most of you know, is a type of the world and of the world system in the Bible. And so this typifies all of Abraham's life as he is called out of Ur and into Canaan. Is going to typify us coming out of the world. When Jesus Christ calls us, we come out of Babylon, out of the world, and into the promises of God. Eventually to the full anti-type of Canaan, which is heaven, the heavenly Canaan land. Canaan can typify two basic things. It can typify the Christian life which we now live and have with God in the present promises of God, and it can typify heaven, which is the ultimate, you know, all the promises of God and all the rest and all the inheritance that God is going to give us, the spiritual land, so to speak. Both are true, and it just depends on, you can look at one or you can look at another, and both often fit. And so we've come out of the world and into Christianity in the Canaan's land, and eventually we'll come out of this world physically and into heaven. And both are seen in the life of Abram coming out of Babylon and into a land that God would show him. It's interesting to note that God didn't tell him where he was going to go when he called him. He calls him in the first part of chapter 12 here, and he just says, into a land that I will show thee. Meaning he had to just go out in total faith in God and believe that God was directing his path and that he would eventually end up where God wanted him to be, which is exactly what happened. And this typifies the fact that our walk is by faith with God and not by sight. God doesn't show us every step of the way. He doesn't tell you what's going to happen to you tomorrow or next week or next year. He doesn't tell you. He gives you basic principles in the Word of God, and he promises that his Spirit will lead and guide you. And then you've got to walk by faith, believing that God will guide you to that land that you've never been to or seen before, heaven, the heavenly Canaan. By the way, this city of Ur has been excavated. The archaeologists have uncovered it and found that this society that Abraham grew up in was highly developed, was highly civilized. But we tend to think, because we've been brainwashed by the theory of evolution, that the farther you go back in society, the cruder and the more basic and the more barbaric man and society was. But that was not the case at all. And in fact, if anything, it seems to be going the other direction. Man seems to be, you know, it's devolution. Man is devolving rather than evolving. He's going down. Not in terms of knowledge and technology, of course. We've accumulated a lot of knowledge now, and it's ended up, resulted in a lot of scientific discoveries and so forth. But as far as the basic nature of man, I wouldn't go so far as to say that man is necessarily individually more intelligent now, as far as native intelligence, than what they had back then. These people were, you know, living 400 or 500 years, I mean, you're going to accumulate a certain amount of wisdom and knowledge about how to live, living 400 or 500 years, plus the fact that they were very close to that first man that God created, Adam, and with his wife Eve, and you just, you know, by virtue of genetics that they were purer in the sense of genetically speaking. There was not the corruption that has come in as a result of the curse and intermarriage and sin and so forth that is followed. So these people were very, very bright, very intelligent. Now, they did not have the capacity to fly through the air in helicopters and drop atom bombs and watch television sets and radio. These inventions, of course, had not come along. So it was basically a more simple society. But that does not necessarily mean that the people were less intelligent, okay? Don't equate the two. Don't equate a more basic society with less intelligence, because it doesn't necessarily stand to reason. They've uncovered and found that they even had such things as indoor plumbing. In Ur of the Chaldees, they had large houses. Some were 2 and 3 stories high, very, very well made. They found royal tombs with all kinds of beautifully hand-carved jewelry and artifacts and highly intricate technology was involved. That place had factories, they had workshops. I mean, it was a regular society, it was a civilization. It wasn't just some barbaric tribe living out in the desert in some tents or something like that. This was a city. But it was a city that was also full of sin, and it was also full of corruption. And that's why God didn't just give them his covenant and then stay there. He said, come out. You've got to come out of it, because this place is of the devil. In fact, they worshipped a god that was worshipped as the moon. And his name, when it's translated into the English, interestingly enough, comes out S-I-N, sin. And it was a moon god, or some feel it was a moon goddess. And she was worshipped. So like I say, they were into the worship of astrology, of the planets, the moon, the sun, the stars, and so forth. And this is a society that God called him out of. From that city, from his family, from all of his ties, to a place where God could work on him and give him promises to come. God promised him many things. He promised him that he would show him a land. That is, he would give him that land when he would get there. He promised him that he would make out of Abraham, or Abram at this point in time, he would make out of him a great nation. You will be a great nation, he said. So he was going to bless him so that the people that would come from him would be a mighty people. He promised that he would make his name great. And Abraham's name has been made great. It's recorded here in Bible history. And Abraham is looked upon in reverence by the Christians, because from him came our Lord Jesus Christ. And through Jesus Christ we're saved. And so that's from Abraham. The Jews look upon Abraham with great respect and reverence, because he's looked upon as being the founder of their nation and the founder of their religion. And even the Muslims, as I said, look upon Abraham with reverence, because Ishmael was the father of the Arabs and Muslim world, and so they look to Abraham. So you've got three world religions that look to this one man. So he made his name great, just as he said he would. He said that he would bless those that would bless Abraham, but he would curse those that would curse Abraham. So he gave him a special promise of blessing and protection from the people round about. And then he said, in that in Abraham all the families of the earth would be blessed. And this has its fulfillment in Christ, because Abraham per se did not bless all the nations or all the families of the earth. He just lived his life and then he died. But through the son of Abraham, Jesus Christ, all have come to be blessed through those that are coming in from them into the gospel. And so it all points to Christ. Every one of these promises have their fulfillment in him. Okay, there's our last bell. When we come back Monday, remember, your reading assignment is due, and we'll pick this up with the story of Abraham and trace it out. Yes. Looks like that one needs to be switched also. If your chart is unreadable, I still have a couple extras up here if you need an extra one.
Also, I came in this little signed roll book.
Who's got the roll book? It's over there. Why don't you get it and sign it, and then you can bring it to me.
My conscience is really bothering me. When you had us write down those, whether we read it or not, I put that I read it, but I read all of it, but about four pages that I didn't qualify.
Uh-huh.